Zaxby's just out-Philly the Philly again. The Zaxby's Chicken Philly is back with garlic aioli, sautéed peppers and onions, decadent melty cheese, and your choice of Zaxby's signature crispy chicken fingers or delicious grilled chicken. But it's only back for a limited time, so enjoy it while you can. No pressure. It's just the greatest sandwich of all time on a ticking clock. Order the Chicken Philly today. Who's got the sauce? Zaxby's.
That's kind of conversation to your soul. That's conversation to your soul.
Hello, Prestige Heads, and welcome to American Prestige. I'm Danny Bessner, here as always with my friend and comrade, Derek Davison, and we are excited to bring you the news. Derek, let's start with this ceasefire in Gaza. But if everyone wants a real detailed analysis, I would point them to the special that we released. It'll be 2 days ago on Wednesday night, where we really go into the details of the ceasefire agreement and what we think it portends for Gaza, Israel, and the Middle East broadly. And so we're not going to recapitulate everything that we talked about then, but Derek, what has been the developments? What have been the developments since we recorded that special?
So just to give people the very basics, the ceasefire is structured as virtually identical to the ceasefire that Joe Biden introduced back in, I think it was May, and then allowed Benjamin Netanyahu to torpedo. It's basically the same deal. It's structured as a three-phase process. Only the first phase has actually been negotiated in any detail, and this is relevant to what's come up today. That's a six-week pause in fighting involving the release of 33 October 7th hostages, and somewhere on the order of, the number keeps changing. At one point it was 2,000. Now I think it's 1,600 maybe, detainees, Palestinian detainees in Israeli custody. And then, you know, the contours of that will be there'll be partial Israeli withdrawal, and then the two sides will resume negotiations after a couple of weeks to make sure this first phase takes hold. And they'll try to negotiate a second and third phase, assuming that they're both negotiating good faith, which is you know, anybody's guess, particularly on the Israeli side. They will try to negotiate a second and third phase. The second phase would see a full Israeli withdrawal, military withdrawal from Gaza, and the release of the remaining living hostages. And the third phase would be moving more into reconstruction. It would see the repatriation of the bodies of deceased October 7th hostages as well. But the details of those phases are completely up in the air because they simply haven't been negotiated yet. So it's for now, at least, a six-week partial ceasefire with the hope that they will be able to extend it indefinitely. What's happened on Thursday, after everybody and their grandmother announced that this was a done deal, Joe Biden, Donald Trump, Qatar, Egypt, everybody said this is a done deal. It's negotiated. Everybody's free and clear. Hooray for us. Benjamin Netanyahu was supposed to hold a cabinet meeting on Thursday morning, late morning, Israeli time, to have his cabinet vote on the ceasefire. This was a formality. It's for certain that if he put it to a vote, that the cabinet would vote in favor. But he decided not to do that. And he made an announcement to the effect that Hamas was reneging on the deal somehow, was trying to grab some extra last-minute concession, and it had changed the deal in some way that he really didn't explain. And he wasn't going to put the deal to a vote now, and it was remained to be seen whether it would ever be put to a vote. This created obviously a bit of a flurry. There's been a back and forth with the Israelis and Hamas, accusing the other of trying to torpedo the deal at the literal, like, beyond last minute at this point. It seems pretty clear that Netanyahu is trying to do what he did the last time this deal was on the table, only at an even later stage in the negotiations, really post-negotiation, to try and undermine this deal. I think that he's been freaked out as a very skilled politician, but somebody who is not exactly a bold politician, I would say, having observed him over his career. He has been cowed by the far-right elements in his cabinet, Itamar Ben-Gvir, Bezalel Smotrich, both of whom have made noises about quitting the cabinet. If they did that together, they would bring down his government. Now, I think this is a bluff because both of those parties would suffer in a snap election or, you know, at best they would come out even. And I think the polling indicates that they would probably lose seats. So I think they're bluffing about this. I don't think they want a snap election. Their only way to stay in government is on Netanyahu's coattails. So I really don't think they would do this, but it's probably been enough to intimidate Netanyahu into at least making it look like he's putting up a fight and putting on a show for these guys so that they'll, take pity on him or something, or feel like he gave them, a show right up until the last minute, and then submit to the cabinet. And they'll certainly vote against the ceasefire, but they, the hope is for him that they wouldn't quit the cabinet at that point. The problem for him is on the other side of this is Donald Trump, and Netanyahu has to account for Trump, who I think may have surprised him a little bit with the way that he weighed in on this negotiation process and kind of pushing things strongly toward a ceasefire instead of giving Netanyahu even more rope than he got from Joe Biden. We don't know. There's been a lot of stories about, the interactions between Netanyahu and Trump's people over the last few days, and who knows what to believe and what's for, PR show purposes. But still, Trump has put his imprimatur on this ceasefire now. He announced it personally. He went to social media, his favorite way to announce things, and made a big deal about this momentous, great ceasefire, taking credit for it. And if it doesn't come to pass, he's going to own that. And so I think Netanyahu has to keep that in mind as well, which is why I think this is all kind of a little one-act play or one-man play that will eventually end with the cabinet, the Israeli cabinet, voting for this thing. They are now supposed to vote on Friday to approve the hostage release deal. We'll see if that actually comes to pass. The whole ceasefire package isn't supposed to go into effect until Sunday, so he does have a few days to play around like this, and for the Israeli military, by the way, to kill as many people as possible, which they seem to be doing. They've killed scores of people over the last 2 days since the ceasefire was announced in Gaza. As far as what exactly the holdup here is, it's still not entirely clear. The consensus that seems to be emerging, and there have been some statements from Netanyahu's office and from reporting from other media outlets, that the issue is supposedly over the identities of the Palestinian detainees who will be released by the Israelis as part of the exchange portion of this package, with Netanyahu's office claiming that Hamas wants to dictate the identities of these people, and the Israelis are reserving the right to veto any names that are on Hamas's list that they find particularly odious, or people who have actually been convicted of violent crimes, that sort of thing. So that's at least publicly what they're talking about. There've been other speculation about disagreements again, as has happened over and over again, over the Israeli military presence on the Gaza-Egypt border, or how quickly and in what stages and what the mechanism is going to look like for the Israeli military to withdraw from some of the places that it's planning to hold on to in Gaza until the last minute, until the end of this first phase, and assuming there is a second phase into that second phase. So a lot of moving parts here. As I say, the plan now is for a vote to take place on Friday. We'll see if that happens.
And really, everyone, we go into significant detail about all of this on our special, so check that out. Derek, let's move on to Lebanon, which has a new prime minister.
The Lebanese president, Joseph Aoun, who was elected, we talked about this last week, started and ended, as it turned out, consultations on Monday with the political parties regarding who he would name as prime minister. In somewhat of a surprise, I wasn't surprised necessarily at the pick. I was surprised it happened so quickly, because it was literally, he started consultations Monday morning. By Monday afternoon, he had settled on Nawaf Salam, who is the presiding judge, or was the presiding judge, of the International Court of Justice at the United Nations. Salam has been talked about in the past as a possible Lebanese prime minister. He's expressed some interest in the job. Mostly this has been pushed by Western governments, the US and Europe, trying to get somebody who is not, let's say, a product necessarily of the Lebanese political machine, and would be maybe more beholden to Western interests in terms of how he interacts with Hezbollah and that sort of thing. They have pushed Salam's candidacy in the past. It's never gone anywhere. But here we are. In this case, he has gotten the job. He's now prime minister designate. He got the support of at least, the last count I saw, was 84 members of parliament. There's 128 members of the Lebanese parliament, so that's well above a majority. Hezbollah and its Shia ally, Amal, basically refused to endorse anybody in the race. I think there was reporting, and it's the way that they're acting kind of bears this out, that they thought they had a deal with Joseph Aoun, that in return for their support for his presidency, that he would renominate Najib Mikati, who was the incumbent prime minister and was serving in a caretaker role. But that clearly didn't come to pass. And so they may be a little bit miffed by that, or they appear to be a little bit miffed by that. Salam, as I say, he hasn't really taken office yet. He doesn't have a cabinet yet. He's supposed to negotiate that. That process usually is pretty contentious, as the parties kind of bicker over who gets to control what fiefdom and you know, which kind of graft opportunities they get to have and which patronage opportunities they get to have. You know, so that may take a while, but I don't know. I thought the prime minister selection process would take a while, and it didn't. So maybe this is a time of surprises for Lebanese politics. Who knows? Salam, as I said, was the presiding judge of the International Court of Justice, and people may be curious about how this is going to affect the ICJ, which is still hearing or still deliberating the case of Israel's conduct, the Israeli military's conduct in Gaza, and whether it rises to the level of genocide. A ruling on that is years away, but the immediate effect is that Salam will be replaced by the vice president or the vice presiding judge of the court, Julia Sebutinde from Uganda. She was the only judge to vote no on all six counts or all six rulings or orders that the court issued last year in the genocide case that was brought by South Africa against Israel for over Gaza. She also voted no in a case in a ruling that the court made later in the year that was just a non-binding legal judgment on the illegality of the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza. So she is decidedly not on the same page as Salam or the rest of the court on these questions of Israel's conduct in the occupied territories. Whether that will have any effect on the court, she has, as presiding judge, she will have some administrative powers, setting schedules and that sort of thing. Obviously, the math, like none of these rulings was a close fought ruling. She wasn't the deciding, or she wouldn't have been the deciding vote or anything like that. So they were fairly lopsided rulings against Israel. So I don't think it's going to change the composition of the court in that sense. But she will have some administrative powers that could be a setback for the legal cases that are before the court or could be before the court.
Let's turn to Syria, where there are concerns over foreign fighters in the new administration.
This has come from a couple of directions. One from the U.S. Apparently, Daniel Rubenstein, the Biden administration's Syria envoy, met with Ahmed Ashara earlier this week in Damascus, or it may have been last week, actually, now that I think about it, but late last week. He met with Ahmed Ashara and conveyed the message that the U.S. is concerned over the fact that the new Syrian government, the caretaker government, whatever you want to call it, led by Hayat Tahrir al-Sham and Shara, has appointed a number of what I think would be fair to say foreign fighters, if not foreign jihadist fighters, who were allied with Hayat Tahrir al-Sham during the Syrian civil war, has appointed a number of leaders of those factions to high-level positions in the emerging Syrian security forces. This is certainly not, you know, a great sign in terms of what this government is going to do, how it's going to administer Syria. It's led to some consternation, as I say, with the U.S. It's also, I think, caused a fair bit of consternation within Syria, and specifically within the Alawite community. And we've talked about the Alawites. They are the most at risk of Syria's minorities right now, because Bashar al-Assad was Alawite. His family was Alawite. There were a number of Alawites in senior positions in his administration. And the community has been subject to what I think is fair to say are retaliatory attacks since Bashar al-Assad was ousted. There have been protests in Alawite-heavy parts of the country, in Latakia province in particular, over the appointment of some of these foreign fighters to these high-level positions. There have now, we've seen evidence of clashes, reports of clashes between what the authorities in Syria are calling pro-Assad militias and the new Syrian security forces. And one of the grievances may be the presence of these foreign fighters at these high levels in the administration. So something to keep an eye on, you know, certainly moving forward, I think.
Thank you, Derek. Lots of things have been happening in Sudan. Let's start with these military, I guess, readvancements.
The big one, which happened over the weekend, was the Sudanese military moved into and retook control of the city of Wad Madani. This is the capital of Sudan's Jazeera state. It had been taken by the Rapid Support Forces paramilitary group in December of 2023. That attack displaced hundreds of thousands of people, many of them already displaced from other parts of the country who had gathered in Wad Madani and had become sort of a humanitarian hub for helping these people, these displaced persons. They were then subsequently re-displaced, and it was a real blow to the humanitarian aid effort as well. Too soon, obviously, to know if the military is going to be able to hang on to the city, but this could be a big turning point in the conflict with the RSF for a couple of reasons. Jazeera State is one of the real breadbaskets of Sudan, and so to control it, could be a real boon for the military in terms of getting agricultural production back online to some extent, to getting food into to people, or you know, kind of getting it back to market and helping in that sense. It's also something of a logistical hub or a highway hub, and the Rapid Support Forces has vulnerabilities here if the Sudanese military can hold on to Wad Madani and hold on to the road nexus, the road networks that come through it. There are RSF forces in southern Khartoum, which is to the north of Jazeera State. There are RSF forces in southeastern Sudan and parts of southeastern Sudan who could be cut off potentially, or partially cut off at least, from other areas under RSF control, which would leave them vulnerable to the military as well. So this is a potentially major development for the Sudanese military.
What about these reprisals?
This has gone hand in hand, basically, with the restoration or the recapture of Wad Madani. There have been reports of attacks against, and it's unfortunately to be expected in this conflict. There have been reports of attacks by the Sudanese military on civilian communities in Jazeera State that are, I guess, accused of having colluded with the RSF or worked with the RSF in some capacity. I'm not clear what people are supposed to do in a situation when the RSF comes in and takes over, which is equally willing to attack civilians, or if not more so than the military, what people are supposed to do other than kind of put their heads down and try to get along with the new authorities. But nevertheless, and I don't know the extent to which there's some special accusation about the communities that are being attacked that they, really actively supported the RSF, or if it's just sort of that they did business with them in a day-to-day way. But we have seen plenty of reports about this. It's risen to the level where the UN has gotten involved, has been issuing warnings and remonstrations to the military about its conduct here. The Sudanese military has sort of disavowed these attacks. It's called them individual violations, kind of, I guess, pinning the blame on soldiers on the ground or maybe mid-level commanders, while disavowing any sort of institutional role in these things. I will say one thing that I know that was newly developed today that we weren't going to talk about, but it's been reported now, is that the U.S. government has sanctioned the commander of the Sudanese military, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan. I haven't seen exactly what that entails, but it's an interesting development. Could be partly related to these reports of attacks on civilians. But also kind of bookends what the U.S. government did earlier this month in sanctioning the commander of the RSF, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo. So, that's another thing that's just sort of developed today.
Let's move to the Horn of Africa, and let's talk about what seems to be good news, which is that Somalia and Ethiopia have agreed to restore full relations with one another.
Yes. Somali President Hassan Sheikh Mohamud was attending a meeting elsewhere in Africa, and on his way back to Somalia on Saturday, he stopped, unannounced, I'm sure the Ethiopian government knew about it, but I'm not sure media or anybody else had been made aware of this or had been publicly announced, but he made a stop in Ethiopia and met with Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed. The two of them agreed to restore full diplomatic relations with ambassadors and everything. If you've been following this story, you will know that Mohamud's government expelled Ethiopia's ambassador from Somalia back in April over the deal that Abiy's government cut with the separatist administration of the Somaliland region. It was basically a port/naval base that Ethiopia would be given the right to lease on Somaliland coastline in return for recognition of Somaliland's independence. That led to months of heated rhetoric, threats on both sides, a lot of outrage from the Somali government that is apparently now moving to the back burner as a result mostly of the meeting that the two of them had in Ankara last month, where Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan, peacemaker that he is, mediated an agreement in principle to kind of put this feud behind them and come to some sort of arrangement where Ethiopia would still get its coastland territory to build whatever it wants to build, naval base, commercial port, whatever it's got in mind, but without sort of undermining the claimed territorial integrity of Somalia. So, that's still yet to be worked out. The idea was that this agreement in principle would be followed up with the technical negotiations to kind of put actual meat on the agreement, which aren't, I think, supposed to begin until next month. So, that hasn't really had a chance to go anywhere. But this agreement to restore full diplomatic relations is another indication that they're at least, still getting along and hasn't fallen apart yet.
Which is good news so far as it goes. Derek, many years ago, a songstress wrote, "Tick-tock on the clock, but the party don't stop." Is the party going to stop with
the party
TikTok?
May stop. Yeah, I don't.
What's
I know
going on with the ban of TikTok?
You're a big TikToker. I know you're scrolling through it even as we do the news here. But
I'm more talk than boy.
There is a ban that's about to come down on January 19th, Sunday, on TikTok in the U.S. This is legislation that was passed months ago by the U.S. Congress, signed into law by Joe Biden, requiring the firm ByteDance, the Chinese firm ByteDance, to either sell TikTok to a U.S. owner or shut down its U.S. operations. There were reports a few days ago that Chinese officials had discussed the idea of selling the app to Elon Musk, which would be really great news for everybody concerned, I think. There was no indication, I should say, that they had even approached Musk or that this was anything more than internal kind of discussions about what can we do here. And so there's no indication that they've actually pursued it. And even TikTok issued a statement calling it fictional. So that's one thing to consider. Fascinatingly, both Donald Trump and Joe Biden now have said that they don't want TikTok to shut down and they don't want the ban to come into effect. I say this fascinating because it was Donald Trump in his first term that got the legislative ball rolling on this ban. And it's Joe Biden who signed the ban into law after it was passed by Congress. And now they both say they don't want it to happen. Trump, in the meantime, has figured out that TikTok can be very helpful to him in getting his message out to his hordes of sycophantic followers. And Biden, I don't know. I don't know if he even is aware of what TikTok is, frankly, but he says he doesn't want the ban to come into effect. I think the company is planning to just shut things down on Sunday if there's no reprieve from the Supreme Court. I imagine as much to make a statement as anything else. But the hope I think that they have is that Trump, having, again, figured out a transactional way to use TikTok, which is the only thing he cares about anything, is what does it do for Donald Trump? Having seen now that TikTok can do things for him, that he will rescind the ban once he takes office, but we'll have to wait and see.
Thank you, Derek. In not particularly shocking news, President of South Korea Yoon has been arrested.
Yoon Suk-yeol was finally arrested. It took police two tries to do this. He was finally arrested Wednesday morning at his residence in the swanky Hanam-dong neighborhood of Seoul. Anti-corruption authorities, the Corruption Investigation Office of the South Korean government, had obtained a warrant for Yoon's arrest earlier this month and tried to implement it a couple of weeks ago at this point, or I think maybe a week and a half ago at this point, only to have presidential security step in and prevent them from exercising the warrant. They had to go back to court and get a new warrant because the first warrant was only good for 7 days. They did that. And then on Wednesday, as I say, they kind of entered the residence again. There was a bit of a standoff, but after a short period of time, Yoon finally surrendered and was taken into custody, insisting that he did so to avoid bloodshed, even though he regards these investigations into his attempted self-coup last month as illegal. Yoon is now facing both the criminal investigations, and there are more than one. The Corruption Investigation Office is one of them, or investigation is one of them, but there are other investigations into basically charges of insurrection for attempting to impose martial law and shut down parliament. He's also supposed to be facing an impeachment trial. He was impeached during the South Korean parliament voted to impeach him, but by procedure, the case then goes to the Constitutional Court of South Korea for final ruling on whether or not the impeachment is legitimate. And he's supposed to be facing trial on that. That was supposed to open on Tuesday. Yoon didn't attend, I think mostly because he felt like he thought if he stepped foot outside of his compound, he would be arrested. So he didn't attend on Tuesday, and they had to adjourn the proceeding after like 5 minutes. They couldn't continue because he wasn't there. They then made plans to resume with or without him on Thursday. I haven't heard any reporting as to whether they did that or whether he was present or not. But, you know, it's not, he's had better days, let's say, Yoon Suk-yeol, and it's not a great time for him. I'm sure that the attempt at becoming, making himself a dictator was worth it on some level, but it's not looking good for him right now.
No, it is not looking good. Speaking of not looking good, let's turn to Russia, Ukraine, and let's start with the new U.S. sanctions.
The Biden administration has really turned on the sanctions spigot over the last week or so. On Friday, it imposed massive new sanctions targeting Russia's oil and natural gas sectors. This is really the first time, because, of course, Joe Biden didn't want to do anything while he was president that might cause global energy prices to rise and affect people at the gas pump. You know, supporting Ukraine is fine, but it only goes so far. So he waited until, you know, really just hours or days left in his presidency before he was willing to oppose these things. If those sanctions are enforced, the U.S., the Biden administration claims it could cost Russia billions of dollars per month. Which would be obviously a major blow to the Russian economy. But of course, it's now up to Donald Trump whether or not to enforce those things. I think most likely he will unwind them, although it's not entirely a given because there are potential ancillary benefits here for U.S. Oil and gas producers. So, you know, it's not out of the question that they could get in his ear and convince him to leave these things in place, or at least not repeal them entirely. The second blitz that happened was on Wednesday. The administration blacklisted, I think, 250 or so, more than 250 companies and other entities, both in Russia and in other countries that are linked to sanctions evasion efforts by the Russian government. Many of those were already under sanction, but were given additional kind of penalties or additional designations by the Treasury Department. This especially, I mean, the oil and gas thing is one thing to leave on Trump's plate. This kind of blitz on Wednesday, I think, was meant to just kind of drown the Trump administration in paperwork effectively, to kind of in hopes that at least some of these will stick. To just kind of wash the, you know, leave them awash in new sanctions to review and bury them under that paperwork, to try and maintain something in, you know, and again, everything about the Ukraine policy for the last several weeks has been geared toward, or at least partially geared toward, Trump-proofing U.S. support for Ukraine, which it now seems is going to continue anyway. The Trump administration, incoming Trump administration, has stopped talking about ending the war, at least anytime soon. They're talking about maybe ending it in a few months or not even at all. So we'll have to wait and see what approach they take.
And let's talk about these advances that Russia has continuously been making.
It's this, I mean, it's the same story that we've been talking about for weeks now. Every week, it's another couple of villages. I think there were five this week that the Russians seized all in eastern Ukraine, in Donetsk mostly. There was one village that they took in Kharkiv Oblast, which is more northeastern Ukraine. But of particular interest, I think, is that they've seized at least one village that lies to the west of the city of Pokrovsk, which we've talked about repeatedly. It's one of the Russians' main targets. It now looks like they may be trying to encircle it with these latest conquests. They have also forced the shutdown of the Pokrovsk coal mine. They seized a village on Monday where one of the mine's main shafts is located. That shaft had already been shut down, but the mine was still partially operational. It was shut down on Tuesday, I believe, that the decision was made to shut it down completely. This is important because the Pokrovsk coal mine was Ukraine's only source of coking coal, which is used in the steelmaking process. So that's a huge blow to the Ukrainian steel industry, which will have to, I guess, import coking coal from other sources outside Ukraine to maintain operations. I don't know how much they have stockpiled, but it's a bigger deal than it sounds like. Oh, they seized a coal mine, big deal. Well, this one was actually a fairly important one. So that's a noteworthy development.
What about this Cuba thing that Biden just did, where he removed Cuba from the state sponsors of terrorism lists?
Yes, in another act of political courage and bravery, Joe Biden, 3 days before he leaves office, decided to remove Cuba from the State Department's list of state sponsors of terrorism. It's basically a mirror image of the move that Donald Trump made in the final days of his first term to put Cuba back on that list. Barack Obama famously removed it in 2015. Trump complained about it and then didn't do anything about it until he was on his way out and left Joe Biden holding the bag to some degree. Now, Biden had heavily criticized Trump's decision in January 2021, again, literally days before he left office, criticized Trump's decision to put Cuba back on the state-sponsored terrorism list, but then left Cuba on the list for 4 years until he was just days away from leaving office. And now he's removed it. Trump will probably put Cuba back on. I can't imagine that Secretary of State nominee Marco Rubio is going to countenance leaving Cuba off of the list. So I would think that could happen pretty soon, actually, or pretty quickly. But there was a deal, apparently, that the Biden administration negotiated with the Cuban government to remove it from the state sponsors of terrorism list. And in return for that, the Cuban government released, I think, 553 prisoners whose status the U.S. had, regards them as political prisoners. So that was the quid pro quo. I don't know how many of them might be rearrested if Donald Trump steps in and undoes what Biden just did. And who knows if he will. Like I said, he was adamant about it last time, and it took him 4 years to do anything about it. So we'll have to wait and see.
Well, Derek, we come to the end of not only this episode of the news, but of also Joseph Biden, Joseph Robinette Biden's presidency, the president that was in power when American Prestige first started. We never broadcast under Trump, so I'm sure that's going to be.
I thought he would be in forever. Frankly, yeah, I'm
so
shocked.
We were thinking, everyone, it would be nice to send him off to Valhalla with some reflections on how Biden did in his term. So from my perspective, he's probably going to be remembered as a pretty bad president overall. I think that he didn't really do much for the domestic economy, regardless of what people were claiming before the election and what he did in his first 2 years in office. It just wasn't nearly enough, and it was never really enough, even in the broadest vision of it. But in terms of foreign policy, I think he's revealed himself to be an absolute fucking disgrace. Those around him were terrible. they committed monstrous crimes. Not only did they commit crimes, but they smirked when they were doing it. And if there was any justice in this world, the people associated with his terrible foreign policy would not find sinecures at prestigious DC think tanks or academic centers at Ivy League universities. Although that will probably happen regardless. So I was just curious, what's your overall take on Biden as a foreign policy president, trying to be as objective as possible, even as we admit that if you're in control of the imperial war machine, things are going to happen?
Yeah, it's hard to be objective about this because I do think they should all be. I don't know if you saw the video of Anthony Blinken's last press availability at the State Department.
Oh, I did. We should put it in the show notes.
Journalist Jake, put it in the show notes. Yep. And I think Max Blumenthal got thrown out first, lambasting him for the genocide. And then Sam Husseini was dragged out by police for trying to ask questions. And you know, on his way out was yelling, "Why aren't you at The Hague?" And he should be at The Hague. Anthony Blinken should be on trial right now as we speak for the things that they've done. So it's hard to be objective. But I think the way to do that is to say, how well did they succeed or fail on their own terms? And I think on that basis, you have to say he was a dismal failure. They came in talking about democracies versus autocracies. They came in talking about centering. The first thing that the State Department did under Blinken was issue a statement about centering human rights in U.S. foreign policy, making human rights the core of U.S. foreign policy. And they were just a disaster on both fronts. I mean, they've discredited the idea of democracy, if anything. They've embarrassed this whole notion of like good guy, you know, on their basis, this good guy versus bad guy conflict that they set up, this dichotomy between the democracies and the authoritarian states. They've shown the democracies to be bloodthirsty, violent in a way that, you know, is hard to even still conceive of. It's been, you know, months that we've had to see it over and over again. Hypocritical. I mean, you know, the response to what happened in Ukraine versus the response to what Israel has done to Gaza. And really they couldn't even make the case on Ukraine before that. They were, you know, there were countries across Africa, across Asia, across the global South, really, that were very skeptical because of U.S., you know, the U.S., you know, everything past, you know, in the past, but certainly now with Gaza having taken place and just the monstrosity of that, it's completely discredited. The notion of human rights being at the center of U.S. foreign policy is laughable, even more so than it was before. And of course, Donald Trump's going to come in and disavow human rights altogether. But I think, you know, while everybody was aghast at that when Trump took office in 2017, because the argument was that rhetoric matters. Even if the U.S. doesn't live up to the rhetoric matters. It matters that you have U.S. presidents who privilege human rights and talk about it as an important thing, even if they fall down on the job. I think that's been, I don't know, what's happened over the last year and a half has turned around even that. I think that it's almost the case that you can regard Trump coming back and just saying "fuck human rights" as a breath of fresh air, as some honesty in this farce that the Biden administration's conduct has shown to be just this completely hollow facade. And so, yeah, I think on that basis, which was the overarching foreign policy message he had as a candidate and coming into office, they're a complete failure. Just everything else aside. You know, the criminal behavior, the moral abomination. You can just say, on their own terms, they were a complete failure.
And it really reveals the actions of this administration and their various responses or lack thereof to happenings around the globe. This is rotted heart that is contemporary liberalism, and that there's nothing there to replace it, and that they weren't able to even mount. They barely mounted a defense against Trump, who they've been bleeding about for fucking years as a fascist threat to democracy. Barely did anything to combat his reemergence onto the American scene in one of the most disgraceful campaigns in modern American history and one of the biggest failures in modern American history. And I think that everyone on the left and liberals as well should really be thinking about what they stand for and what their ideology actually is going to mean as we go further into the 2020s and as we have these two senescent leaders going back and forth, which will for what will have been a more than a decade. So I think on that note, Derek, let's give one final let's go, Brandon.
Let's go.
As always, everyone, thanks for listening and keep on rocking in the free world. Bye.
Bye.